I'm Richard Harris, and welcome to Real Risk, the podcast that talks to people who put themselves in harm's way. You know the type. Big wave surfers, professional soldiers, base jumpers. I'll get inside the heads of men and women who seem fearless or even reckless. They might seem crazy to us, but most are far from it. We'll be talking about putting your life on the line for something important. We're talking about real risk. I think everyone knows the famous quote uttered by George Mallory in 1923 when the New York Times newspaper asked him why he wanted to climb Everest. "Because it's there," he quipped. He went on to say, "The answer is instinctive, a part, I suppose, of man's desire to conquer the universe." For me, that quote defines the visceral need to explore. When asked the same question about cave diving, my friend Craig Challen likes to say, "If you have to ask the question, you wouldn't understand the answer." And I think he's right. You either get it or you don't. My guest today, well, he gets it. He is, in caving circles, one of the living greats. Famous for his massive siege-like expeditions into some of the world's deepest caves, and is one of the rare proponents who is equally adept at deep vertical dry caving and cave diving as well. He's an engineer who's developed extraordinary life support and mapping technologies to assist with his explorations, and now he has his sights set on the ultimate prize, the discovery of extraterrestrial life forms. In Texas, my guest today is Dr. Bill Stone.
Good evening, Bill Stone. Thank you very much for joining me on Real Risk.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Bill, like many cavers around the world, I was always amazed by the sheer scale and almost audacity of your expeditions, especially when I read your book, Beyond the Deep. It describes the triumph and tribulation of an exhausting multi-week expedition in Mexico. And I want to talk to you about that in detail. But before we do, let's go back to the start. How did you get drawn to exploration, Bill?
Oh, that was easy. I was in high school, and a flyer came out in 10th grade in September when school starts over here. And it was announcing a meeting of the spelunking club. And I had never heard that word before. And so I had my mother drive me over to the meeting. And there were some people from the local caving club. This was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, showing slides. And one of them was the picture of this guy rappelling into a fairly well-known cave in West Virginia that had a 55-meter freefall rappel into it. And so you have this guy on a thin gold-colored rope with the sun shining down, lighting moss up, and below him was just utter blackness. And so, you know, that photo just totally captivated me. And we hooked up with them, and pretty soon, within a year, we were having to go out of state to hook up with other people to do bigger, deeper stuff. And you know, within 3 years, we were out of the country going to Mexico. So it was pretty rapid how things progressed back then. When I started, we were still climbing ropes with prussic nuts. And then it just rapidly expanded into mechanical ascenders and Kern mantle ropes and, you know, underground camps and you name it. It all happened pretty fast.
How old were you when you did your first big trip down to Mexico?
I was 19. Not even 20. Yeah. And we organized that all the way over from New York State. So it was about a 3 day solid, you know, nonstop drive with people rotating shifts 24 hours a day. And then we showed up down there, and it was magical. Back in those days, most of the stuff in Mexico was unexplored. A couple of very famous things had been discovered, like Golondrinas, this 376 meter freefall shaft, which is why we went. We went to see that. I think we were like the third or fourth group to actually descend it. But the crazy thing was the second time we went down, the people in Austin, Texas, who were the organizers for what is, well, it's been around for 50 years now, called the Association for Mexican Cave Studies. And those people were, unlike what I would say most territorial cavers are today, they showed us topographic maps and marked them up and said, "Here, these areas right here have had no investigation at all. Why don't you go down and see what you can find?" You know, so they were giving us areas to go investigate, you know, at a time when there's just so much to be done that nobody had enough time to go. And so they were very open about showing us what they knew.
That is generous, because cavers can be a cagey bunch, as you know.
Oh, I do. I do.
Including you and me, probably.
No, I honestly, I try to be pretty open. I don't carry many secrets because the places we try to get to take a lot of work to get there. So it's...
Yeah. Did you have any particular mentors or people you remember from those early days?
Specifically for cave diving, absolutely. It was Sheck Exley.
Yeah.
And so I got to know him very well over the course of 14 years. He picked me up when I was, 25, 26. And, I read an article that he had written. And when we started, it was the discovery of the San Augustine sump in Wautla. And it became pretty apparent that it was going to be deeper and longer than what we were prepared to do. And so I had read this article, Hazen wrote him, and I said, "Hey, we got this problem. I'd like to, you know, to learn," because back in those days they didn't have cave diving training organizations. It was an apprenticeship arrangement, and so if you got somebody who knew their stuff, they would offer to train you. And so they were just, I think they were just starting the NACD back then, and then the National Speleological Cave Diving Group came in a couple of years later. But yeah, I got all my C cards from Sheck.
That is very cool. And for those who are listening who don't know about Sheck Exley, in our sport of cave diving, he was without question, you know, one of the doyens of the sport, and wrote an extraordinary occasional paper, I guess you'd call it, called A Blueprint for Survival, where he outlined the five cardinal rules of cave diving, which almost certainly led to a vast improvement in the safety of the sport and probably saved many, many lives. And almost all accidents that have followed, you know, you can almost certainly point to one of those rules that have been broken.
That's actually can be shown numerically. At the time that Sheck wrote that book, there had been over 450 fatalities in Florida Springs alone up to that date. And within a year of the publication of that book, there was an exponential drop off in fatalities. So I think probably more than any single instruction, you know, course, training agency or whatever, that book saved a lot of people's lives. And I think we're kind of, you know, at the point where we're seeing that in rebreathers, where the, you know, the experimental stage with people pushing it and, you know, a lot of people dying on rebreathers. And now it's becoming a bit more codified, I suppose, reliable, however you want to put it.
Yep. So did cave diving take over at that point? Did you move away from caving for a while?
Oh, no. The one thing to understand, at least as far as me, is that cave diving was just a tool. It was one more tool in my kit. And I only got into it because we had an underwater tunnel at the bottom of a very deep cave that I wanted to find out where it went. It was as simple as that. I found that, you know, by the middle of the 1980s, they did have training agencies, and a lot of people saw, you know, a cave diving card as a badge, you know, that they could say, "Hey, I'm a cave diver here. See my card." You know, I never looked at it that way. To me, I was, there's a funny story that, I don't know if you know Leo Dickinson. He was a cinematographer for all kinds of adventure dramas for the BBC and HTV for a long time. He knew this famous climber in Britain named Dick Willens. He was one of their top guys in the 60s and 70s. One day, Leo had gone over to say hello to him, and he was in his garage getting ready to leave, and he had a scuba tank in his car. And Leo looked over and said, "Well, what are you doing with that scuba tank in your boot?" He says, "Oh, I've taken up scuba diving." And Leo says, "But did you get certified?" And he goes, "No." And he goes, well, how are you doing that? He says, "Well," he says, "I have a compressor there. And if you got a compressor, you don't need a C card." and that was the end of that, you know? And strangely, that's how I've lived my life for over 40 years now. I built diving equipment. And so to me, having a compressor and a Haskell booster and a bunch of K bottles of oxygen and helium were just what fit in the garage. And I never went to a dive shop from that point forward. And so it was your own safety agency that you had to really develop. And so we had to sit down and go, okay, how are we going to handle the pressures on these things? What's a safe pressure? As you probably know, there was this period, it may still exist, where people with open circuit scuba said, how much gas can I get in my, my tank. And so the classic Florida rig back in those days was these twin 104 cubic foot press steel, you know, heavier than sin tanks. They were rated for 2,400 PSI. And people like Exley and everybody else who was out there in front line were pumping these to 4,000 because they knew what the burst pressure was. And they said, well, it's not going to burst at 4,000. I'm just going to go there. And so dive shops got in the habit of doing this, you know, until one incident where some guy went out and had his aluminum tanks repainted at a car body shop, and they put them in the oven to anneal the paint. And of course, you know what happened to the aluminum, and that resulted in a couple of fatalities at the dive shops where he tried to pump those tanks. And since then, people have been a little more circumspect about, you know, what they're doing with regard to overpressure. And of course, once rebreathers came around, what was the use in overpressurization? You know, you've got so much more efficiency. You don't need to play those games anymore.
Well, the book I mentioned is centered around this particular cave system in Mexico. And tell me if I say it incorrectly, Bill, because I know you speak pretty good Spanish, the Sistema Huatla. How did you first get involved in exploring that cave? That was one of those early trips?
No. Actually, I had been going to Mexico for 6 years at that point. And it was that area was considered to be off limits, I guess might be the term. In the late 1960s, you know, there was the counterculture movement in the U.S. and the Nixon administration established the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And those guys used their newfound power to go and bully the Mexican government to harass any young Americans, i.e. hippies, who might be in the country. And there was a reason that hippies might want to go to Huatla, because even before cavers knew about it, they were going there for psilocybin mushrooms. So the Mexican military, at the request of the U.S. government, went in and put up roadblocks with machine guns. And everybody was turned back who looked like a non-Mexican. And so that was the status of affairs for almost 8 years. And then one fine day in summer of 1976, somebody read a report that a French Canadian team had gotten in somehow. And this guy, Richard Schreiber out of Georgia, who was on one of the late 60s trips that did the original exploration of those caves, said, hey, I'm organizing an expedition. It's secret, but do you want to come? And if so, can you pull together a team of Texans? And so I did. I was at the University of Texas in Austin at that time, working on my PhD. So we organized a group of five. There were eight other people that came from Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia area. And down we went. And sure enough, when we got there, it was open, but it was alien. It's effectively like being on an indigenous reservation. The people there were never conquered by the Spaniards, the Mazatecs. And even to this day, they still probably 95% of them speak Mazatec. And the kids do speak some Spanish, but it's still difficult communicating up there.
So what year was that? Sorry, Bill.
That was 76. And from that point forward, we pretty much went every year, sometimes twice a year, until probably around 1979. And somebody got the idea that, hey, you know, it takes so much effort to come down here. Why don't we just start thinking about once a year and going for longer? And so we started doing 3 and 4 month expeditions at that point. You know, and so when you add it all up, starting in 1979, the first time we did a long range expedition until today, I spent 9.5 years on expeditions.
Is that right? Gee, that's enormous. When you first went there, the cave was about 800 meters deep vertical. Is that correct?
It was only 600 meters deep when we arrived. And when we left, it was 860.
Okay.
But it stopped at this underwater tunnel, and it took us, you know, a couple of years to figure out what to do about it. First, we went back with little tiny pony tanks, you know, 15 cubic feet. Doesn't get you very far. And then 2 years later, after working with Sheck, we came back with the first composite high pressure tanks, which we built in collaboration with NASA. We got some of their centers to help us out and one of the manufacturers to help us. And so we built these 6,500 PSI. In those days, it was S-glass epoxy. Today, it's carbon epoxy. So they were, you know, it cut the weight of the tanks by a factor of 3, and it enabled us to get a couple of 95 cubic foot tanks down there. And we did 2 dives in 81 that showed that it was going and big and just, you know, going down and keeping on going. So, you know, at that time, we had discovered the resurgence, which was about, well, I don't know, 10 kilometers away. And so we went there, and for the next couple of years, we used that same equipment to dive the resurgence. That was the Pena Colorada. And you probably know Andreas Klocker and that crew down there who have been going back and working a lot of that. So that cave sat unaddressed for almost 30 years from 84, a little more, 33, I think, until he came back. And then we started looking at rebreathers at that point because the open circuit was just not going to make it.
And was there a dye tracing project to connect those two, the resurgence to where you were working?
There was. The dye trace didn't happen until after that expedition. They got a positive dye trace in 1987, and it was strong enough that it turned the river green 14 kilometers away from the main system. So they knew it went that way.
Yeah. Then you've really got a project once you know that.
Yeah. You know, and so that whole thing, it was one step leading after another where we would keep hitting these hard walls of, you know, you couldn't go any further. We weren't trying to do things like they were in Florida, like stage diving and using scooters because we couldn't transport them. It was just too much weight. But in a discussion that happened on that Pena Colorada expedition in 84, that was the transition to where we started thinking about rebreathers. And back then you couldn't buy one. They weren't really available and they weren't suitable for cave diving. And so I started designing my own.
I mean, this project is a dream come true for cavers and cave divers. And, you know, I've been involved in similar things, but not on quite your scale. But the need to problem solve as you work your way further into a cave, you come up against a new obstacle, and then you have to create or invent a solution that is not off the shelf at that stage. And for an engineer like yourself, this must have been very, very desirable situation.
No, we didn't think of it that way. You know, if I could have walked into the hardware store and said, hey, please give me a redundant rebreather, I would have bought it if I had the money, or I would have tried to get somebody to, you know, give us a grant so we could buy it. But what happened was instead I went to BioMarine, which was called Rexnord back in those days. And I said, hey, I got this great idea. You know, we're doing exploration. How about you guys, you know, help us build this architecture right here? You know, and I had studied a little bit of what they did by looking at what the Navy used. And they all said, well, first of all, you don't have a clearance. And the second thing is that each of these rigs will cost you $50,000. And that was in 1984. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board and said, well, okay, you know, I guess we're going to have to start from scratch. The funny thing, the ironic part is that over the next 10 years, I probably spent easily 10 times the amount that they had asked for to buy those two rebreathers. And but in the end, you know, we had something that was actually safe for cave diving.
It turns out that in parallel, this rebreather design and build project led you to another extraordinary exploration project in Wakulla Springs in Florida. How did that sit alongside the Mexican project?
It was completely parallel. It was a pure cave diving project. And to me, it was just a step along the development path to get back to Wattla and go to the San Augustine Sump. In fact, the original proposal to the state of Florida was that we simply wanted to use the spring to test life support equipment. And when I wrote it, the state of Florida, actually came back and said, well, we'd like you to revise your priorities somewhat. And I called them back up and said, well, okay, I'm not sure what you mean. And they said, well, could you do some exploration while you're doing your testing? I said, well, okay, I'll talk to my friends. And I mentioned this to Sheck Exley, and he said, well, heck yeah, you know. And the next thing you knew, we had, you know, 15 of the best cave divers in the country were there for 3 months. And I was just kind of like the whatever you want to call it, the shepherd, you know, moving things around on the surface and making sure all the gear was there. But it was really people like Exley and Rob Parker and Clark Pitcairn and Wes Skiles and those people who were, you know, pushing things out. Paul Heinerth was in that group as well. And, you know, we designed a variable depth habitat for that project to get people out, because we knew from the calculations ahead of time we were going to be looking at pretty uncomfortable decompressions, you know, like on the order of 9 to 10 hours. And so we had this 10-foot diameter habitat that you could get into and adjust your height as your stops were passed. So from about 80 feet up or down, rather, you could ratchet your way back to the surface. And that actually worked out okay. We did a little bit better 12 years later, when we went back, we actually had a mini sat system where the divers were recovered in a transfer capsule at 30 meters down, and then we pulled them straight back to the surface and put them in a habitat so they could put some dry fire resistant clothes on and get some food and sleep while the people on the surface stayed up and took care of the decompression. Much nicer way to go, I might add.
I mean, your projects are all classic Bill Stone, if you don't mind me saying this. So complex and engineered and every detail attended to. And the Cislunar rebreather, which was a product of this project, from what I read, it was so complex and so extraordinary, it actually seemed to intimidate the people a fair bit who were diving it. And I gather that caused a little bit of stress amongst the crew.
I think you're separating the original prototypes from the ones we used on the San Augustine expedition. The original prototype nobody wanted to touch except for Sheck Exley, and he took like 12 minutes of instruction sitting on shore with this thing that weighed over 100 kilograms, and then immediately jumped into the water and was under for 3.5 hours. You know, that was Sheck. He just assimilated, you know, the knowledge and then went. But when we went to Wautla in 94, which was 7 years later, we had gone through four more generations, and people were expecting things to be perfect, and they weren't. These were still experimental rigs, and you had to pay attention to what you were doing. You could easily still put an empty CO2 absorbent canister in the thing, and we didn't have a switch that would tell you that it was empty. You know, things like that. We didn't have a way to tell you what your carbon dioxide level was. We didn't have at that time. Well, no, we did. We did have integrated decompression at that time. So that was not an issue. I think a lot of it then was not a problem with the rig. The rigs worked. There's no question about that. To give you an example, we did 22 dives on that project. Now, that doesn't sound like much, except that these are 22 dives starting at 860 meters below the surface of the Earth. And everything has to be carried in there. Everything. We did those 22 dives, many of which were several hours in duration during the initial exploration runs. And even after we knew the route, there was over 600 meters of, it was about 680 meters of diving to get through those two sumps. That was still an hour and a half to get through the whole thing with your bag of equipment and all that kind of stuff. So in the end, we had logged, I don't know, somewhere around 80 or 90 hours of a person diving on that trip. And here's the crazy statistic that blew everybody away when we finally added it up. We used 50 cubic feet of oxygen and 90 cubic foot of heliox. That was it for the entire expedition. We never fired a compressor, never used a gas booster, never used any other gas that was on the surface. That was it. One set of gear went down and we did all that.
That's why we love rebreathers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a powerful machine if you know how to do it. But part of the problem was it's an intimidating place. It was a very intimidating place and still is. We had a camp right there at the bottom at the sump, but there was a waterfall, 10-meter waterfall, not 30 meters away, and it was just shaking the entire tunnel all the while you were there. And so even when you're sleeping, you kind of had to like wrap everything you could around your head so you didn't, you know, have to listen to that all night. And then when you got up, you know, you're working and the place is just shaking and roaring and there's mist in the air. And, you know, if you're not used to vertical caving, which a lot of these people weren't, because we had to recruit people who were good at diving to understand how to dive a rebreather before you could even think about training them in vertical caving to get them down there. So you had this dual discipline thing that was filtering out everybody. You know, we tried for years to get people to sign up. And by the time we were done, we only had 10 divers. And then a lot of those, I would say 60%, were mainly cave divers from Florida, you know, and around the world, not deep cave explorers. And so you put them down there, you know, 860 meters deep, and we've done much deeper dives, you know, in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, you know, where you're down way over 1,000 meters. Those people are thinking about what's above them, not thinking about the dive, and you can't do that. You know, if you talk to anybody who has been in the astronaut corps, for example, they'll tell you that one of the things they do is they try to pre-create the experience before you go. And you just do it day after day after day in simulators so that if something does happen, it doesn't surprise you, you know? And the problem with them is that caving was so novel that they were terrified just by the mere fact of where they were. and they couldn't block that out and focus on what they had to do, which was the diving. And so, you know, to myself and a few others who were cavers ahead of time, once we got to the water, it was what we trained for. And what happened above the water was what we lived for decades. So that was home to us. You know, being down there was just no big deal. Getting into the water, that's what we trained for. And when we got in the water, we knew what we were doing and we weren't thinking about what was above or below us. And I think that was really what separated this perception of fear, you know, or lack of faith in the equipment. You know, it worked. The gear worked.
There's no doubt in my mind that incremental increases in experience are vital for any kind of activity like this, whether it's the dry caving or the diving itself. And, you know, the zero to hero phenomenon usually ends very poorly. People need to have that time underground or underwater to get comfortable so that when problems arise, they're ready for it. So does simulation or even pre-visualization play a strong role for you and your team, Bill?
I was never into this Zen pre-visualizing thing. I knew what I was doing, you know, because we had rehearsed it so much. I had been in the dive twice previously. And so when we came back to Florida for training, what we did is we tried to pick places that had a similar morphology. And then we would go and do things like drag a 70 kilogram backpack of equipment through, you know, haul sack of equipment, not a backpack. Through those tunnels using the rebreathers. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but we spent 4 months living at a place called Jackson Blue Spring in Florida, because once we understood the shape of the cave and the fact that it went down to over a little over 30 meters depth, that you were working with currents, that you were working in a tunnel that was roughly, 8 to 10 meters in diameter. This was almost a duplicate of what we were dealing with down in Wautla. And so we said, okay, this is it. This is where we're going to rehearse. And so we did that for 4 solid months using, you know, rebreathers and haul sacks with equipment that just the very thing. We simulated everything from loading up the backpacks to getting into the rebreathers in the dark. We would do dark missions. So we'd wait until after night, you know, fell. And then everybody would have helmets on, cave lights, and would kit up on a platform just like we were going to do in the cave over the water in the dark, with people helping them put their gear on. So it was like we always had teams where there was somebody on the surface who was helping you get all your equipment on while you're sitting on this platform. And, you know, you went through the pre-dive checks the same way as everything else. And then you went and you ran your mission in the cave. You came out in the dark. You simulated getting all the gear out, what you were going to do with it when you got on the other side. And I think as a result of that, people who had done that simulation, had paid the dues and spent that 4 months doing that, they did fine down in Wautla when the actual thing happened.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty high fidelity training.
Well, we knew it was risky. You got to understand, back in those days, you didn't go out and just buy a rebreather. Right? In 1994, there really were no other groups out there. It wasn't until like 95, 96 that AP Valves started making them, and so did Cislunar. And that was pretty much what you could find back in those days in the way of mixed gas, electronically controlled rebreathers. I remember that when we had those rigs and I offered them to Sheck Exley for the work they were doing at Zacatone, he said, you know, it's just a bit too technical and I know how to use my gear, so I'm going to stick with my gear. You know, Sheck had this Southern accent. It was pretty thick. But that's how he was. You know, he wasn't ready to make that jump to something that he didn't quite see the benefits of. We tried showing it to him. A lot of those old time, you know, first line Florida cave divers who were doing groundbreaking stuff there, they didn't really, you know, they saw it as newfangled technology and, you know, they weren't really sure where it was going to go or what it was going to do. So we had to convince the people that we were with that, look, this is worth it. And the logic played itself out in those gas consumption numbers I told you a little earlier. You know, we knew that these things at 30 meters depth were going to be pushing 150 times the efficiency of open circuit gas. And so getting them to train them so they knew what to do when things went wrong. Here's something just to give you an idea of how we handled, some of this risk. If somebody comes to you and says, hey, I want to learn rebreathers, you know, I'm going to go do deep diving. The first question I ask those people, in fact, even anybody who comes to me and says, I want to become a cave diver, I say, why?
You're listening to Real Risk, the Adventure Podcast with Richard Harris.
Why do you want to become a cave diver? Are you just going out there to be able to get a C card, you know, and say that, you know, hey, I'm a cave diver, or do you have a reason? And to me, it's like, if you don't have a rational reason to do it, don't. You know, you say, okay, I'm interested in understanding where this sump goes in this cave. Or, hey, I found a spring on my friend's property and I'd really like to explore it. I say, okay, let's talk about what you got to go through to safely do that. You know, and the first thing I do is run them through, you know, a set of courses that are now available that would get them to a point where they could, you know, do the technical aspects of it correctly, and then try to set them up with somebody who could get them some experience in the actual environment and then help them out. And so in our case, the problem was that nobody had that experience. We were creating it ourselves. And as you know, a rebreather is a powerful device. It's like giving somebody a Lamborghini and saying, here, look at this fine car. And the person gets in the car, puts the pedal down, goes 240 miles an hour and slams into a tree, you know, and you were about to say, by the way, you know, you need to be careful going around bends with these things because physics is against you. Okay. Well, that's the thing with rebreathers. If you go in without the discipline to learn how these things behave and how they work, I'll give you a good story here. You know, I'd known Scheck for a long time, but another person I have a tremendous amount of respect for is Rick Stanton. And I have watched Rick, the way in which he goes about using equipment. Sometimes they've built their own, you know, I would call them garage rebreathers rather than engineered rebreathers. And I kind of joked one day that, you know, Stanton could dive a refrigerator and still come back, you know, even if it wasn't a proper piece of diving kit. Because he had this mental discipline that forced him to go down this chain of assessment of the equipment, both before the dive, during the dive, you know, at any given point. And he had the ability to decide that, you know what, things aren't doing so well right now. I'm bailing out, you know, irregardless of how much effort it took to get to that dive site. Florida cave divers, they really don't have much pressure. If they get to the dive site, they've driven there and they say, you know what? Visibility looks kind of bad. I'm not going to go diving today. You take somebody who's on an expedition, like you're going to the bottom of Cueva Cheve now, that's a 4-month expedition. And those divers are like at the tip of the sphere and there's 80 people supporting them. And it takes 2.5 months to get that diving equipment down there, the cave rig, the camp set, the food transported, the diving gear at the dive site. And then they're supposed to come in and do their thing. And if you get down there and you have a leaky regulator, right, there's a lot of people who would sit there going, God, all these people did all this. You know, I'm on, you know, I've got to do something, right? Well, the answer is you don't. And this is where a lot of people make a fatal mistake. You have to maintain that discipline no matter what. So, you know, that's kind of one point. And the other one, going back to rebreathers, is back in those days, they were new and we had to establish those safety procedures. And so we did things then that I am absolutely certain that nobody in a training agency does today. And I'll give you a good example. We put every diver that went to Wattla on the rebreather and we turned off the oxygen on a bench in the garage. And we said, okay, I want you to keep on breathing. And I'm going to ask you at various points, how do you feel? And you're going to give me a signal with your hand. And if I don't get the proper signal from my hand, I've got an oxygen respirator here that I'm going to put over your mouth, you know, and pump some oxygen into you. And by doing that, every single person who was on there felt viscerally and personally what it felt like to black out from hypoxia. And we repeated those experiments until they knew what the feeling was like. And the reason I say that is because if you talk to a physiologist, they're going to tell you, well, you know, those symptoms don't happen for everybody. And that's exactly right. And so if they didn't, we said, you know what, don't mess around if it looks like, you know, you're getting into this situation. The reason we did it was because, and this is sadly, I believe, the culprit behind probably several hundred, if not more, fatalities with rebreathers, is that it is possible to spoof the oxygen system in a rebreather if you get condensate on the sensors. And we spent years working at Poseidon trying to figure out how to auto-calibrate and auto-validate sensors during the course of a dive. And we succeeded in doing that. And today, it's still the only rig out there that will do that. I'm not, this is not a pitch for Poseidon. What I'm saying is that there are failure mechanisms in these things. And if you don't have the ability to sense that you're going hypoxic because you never did a bench test, you never actually went hypoxic, you wouldn't catch it. And then you'd black out because hypoxia is the easiest way to go right now.
I do want to insert a quick safety message to all our listeners who might be rebreather divers that this is not something to do at home without exceptional levels of safety equipment and supervision, because doing it by yourself in your shed can almost certainly end in a fatality. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of people say that hypoxia is the silent killer because people don't see it coming. But as you say, it may be that you can train yourself to recognize it, or that some people will never recognize it, even having been exposed to it. It's certainly something that all rebreathers should be very fearful of. You know, there'll be people listening to this who'll go, well, you go down a cave and, you know, you take all this diving equipment and you get set up at the water's edge and you go for a dive. It's not something that I'd like to do, but it doesn't sound too terrible. But the brutal reality of vertical caving and transporting diving equipment and living underground is actually extraordinarily tough thing to do. You know, it's physically and mentally very, very taxing. Can you paint us a bit of a picture at life at Camp 4, which I gather was the camp just before the sump camp?
Well, so that it would be Camp 5 if you're talking about San Augustine in 1994. We actually had a Camp 4 in Cheve in 2017 that was beyond the first underwater tunnel, and we were out there for about 2 weeks. Camp 5 in San Augustine was at the bottom of it was roughly a 300 meter deep gorge, and there's no dry spots. It's basically a canal at the end, and then the ceiling comes down to the canal, and there's a giant waterfall right beforehand that's shaking the whole place up. And so we had to put rock bolts in the ceiling of the tunnel and suspend these portable platforms. They're kind of like scaffolding that you would use, you know, on the side of a building, except that we had designed them to be very, very compact and lightweight and collapsible. So that was where we worked. We put hammocks from rock bolts and slept in those. We had a little shelf that we built with a stove and things like that for cooking. And so that was dive base. And then below that, there was a platform right at the water level where you would kit up, and somebody would actually be on rope on rappel, because it was basically a 1.2 meter square platform, not big enough for more than one person. And the other people who were helping kit up would actually be on rope. They'd be hooked in with their harnesses and hanging out over the water, passing pieces back and forth to the person there. Other than that, like I say, you know, it was a matter of experience in that environment. And I'd been doing that at that time for 20 years. And so it was a very known environment to me. To others who were pure divers, they were thinking about all the stuff they got down. There were 100 meter drops, free fall on the way to get down there, probably 40 or 50 pitches, about a kilometer and a half of rope just to get to the dive site. And so you do spend a lot of time doing very rigorous work. You're carrying 20, 25 kilogram packs below you on rope. Going down's easy because you got gravity. Going back up, not so easy. And we were always shuffling pieces of equipment up and down that we had to replace or repair or whatever, and bring tanks out, bring new tanks in that had been charged. We had dry suits. I mean, the thing about it is, it's like you can envision doing a dive at a spring site where you drive up with your van and you have an entire van full of dive gear to do a cave dive. Well, all of that stuff has to be transported down in haul sacks underground, in addition to all of your camping equipment, your food, your lighting, everything like that. Back in 1994, we were using carbide for lighting. Nobody really remembers that if you didn't live through it. But we would go through on the order of 400 or 500 kilograms of carbide on an expedition like that, 4-month project.
What's the longest period you've spent underground without seeing the sunshine, Bill?
Boy, that's a good question. It's probably like 19 and a half days, which was a push that we did in J2 back in 2009. I've totaled 735 days at underground camps now. So it's kind of a familiar place to me. You know, I just, once you get there, you know, it's like pressure's off. You pick these sites because you want to try to have them dry. Of course, the San Augustine sump was a unusual, aberration to that. That's about as weird as it gets, is being in a hammock suspended over a sump with a waterfall right behind you. The most of them we try to pick in dry passages where the wind isn't too bad, and you can actually get out of all your wet gear and kind of recover and regroup. We handle a lot of the safety issues these days by communication. Back in those days, there was nothing. If you had a problem, somebody would have to spend a couple of days climbing back out to the surface, solve the problem. You know, it might take a few days, and then another couple of days to get back down. Today, we have a earth conducting, you know, single wire communication system that goes through the cave. And for next year at Cheve, we've just built a system that'll do a roughly a 1200 baud data transmission. So we uplink both our survey files and our notes for what's needed at each of the camps on the way. And so the ability to logistically coordinate things has just gone up exponentially with the use of that gear.
So like all cavers and cave divers, you've lost friends to the sport. When that happens, Bill, do you ever reconsider the activity you're involved in, or does it ever, have you ever thought about giving it away?
Short answer to that is no. To me, it's like you're only given so many days here on this planet, and if you're going to put the effort in to go do something, you should follow through with it. Is there a risk that, somebody is going to die? Hell yeah. This always gets me, is the dichotomy between what we do and what NASA does with regards to the posture for space exploration. To them, it's an attempt to assure zero risk, and you can't do that and actually explore. So when we're working on an expedition like we do and like you do, you realize that each single person is responsible for themselves. You can't have a mission control looking over your shoulder and protecting you every second of the way where you're going. And that's true, not just of cave diving, but just of anything you're doing underground. If you're on a rope, you know, and you make a mistake at a rebelay, it's going to cost you your life. And it has. And, you know, so you asked, you know, how many people have I've had 23 close friends who have died on expeditions. And four of those were on projects that I ran. And I can tell you, you don't want to have it happen. You know, it is the most devastating emotional experience you can ever have in your life, is to lose a team member on a project. In some cases, the ones I was on, we were right at the end of the project. It happened, during cleanup or de-rigging and things like that. And so it was logical to close things up. In other cases, it was right in the middle of a project, like a 4-month project. And that's what happened in 94 in San Augustine. And it was like, okay, you know, we've all been training for this now for 10 years. This is it. We either make a go of it here or we don't, you know. And, you know, aside from, you know, the cliche of the St. Crispin's Day speech, you know, that's kind of how it went in base camp, a couple of days after we got Ian Roland out and things settled down. So it was basically going to be, all right, it's going to be a team vote. You know, are we staying and going to continue on with this, or are we going to quit? And in that particular case, it was somewhat a timid, well, okay, yeah, we'll stay around for National Geographic and film it, and then we'll see what happens. And, you know, that was like, okay, you know, at least we have a little bit of a respite here to think about how to regroup. And I used that time to go back down and dive the second sump in San Augustine and show that there was going tunnel beyond. And that was enough to get sufficient people to stay till the end, that we could support a crew going across there, setting up a camp and exploring. It's all a rational assessment of what is risk and what is fear. And I think if you can extract the element of fear through training and rehearsal, then you are much more able to quantitatively assess the risk and say, you know what, we can do this, and we can do it, and we're both going to come back alive. And that's what Barbara Mendy and I did back in 94, and it worked out.
That's an excellent bit of philosophy, Bill. Just talking again briefly about the loss of your friend and expedition member, Ian Roland, who you mentioned, that I can imagine that must have been particularly difficult, because not only were you the team leader, obviously, but he was diving the rebreather that you'd designed. And although it's very clear from what I've read that the rebreather continued to work perfectly and was not at fault, the team were almost mutinous at that point. That was the point in that expedition that left me with tremendous admiration for your drive and tenacity, Bill, that you managed to work through that, keep a part of the team together to complete that mission. Was that about as testing a time as you've ever had?
Yeah. It certainly was emotionally tough. So, yeah, I can almost verbatim quote the whole scenario that happened there. You know, to me, it was like we had all paid our dues. We had spent the time to learn the equipment. And in fact, I was expecting that the whole thing was going to proceed extremely fast and that people like Ian Roland were going to be the ones out front, you know, over on the other side, you know, what proved to be 680 meters away. And I was just going to, you know, do support shuttle, bringing food over to those guys and let them take off. Ian was a force of nature. You know, he was just a born leader and he was driven, you know, to make everything happen. And he had his Royal Air Force, you know, discipline training. So he was there, man, you know, all right, guys, you know, up at 7 a.m., we got things to do. Let's go. You know, he was a self-starter. Yeah. So we expected them to just knock out the sump and we'd be moving on. And it turned out that there were a number of people that were on the first diving wave who were just intimidated by things. And then there was a swap out in which Kenny Broad, who's still around and doing a lot of diving, and Ian were next up. And those guys were a great team. And they methodically, you know, knocked the whole thing out and discovered the way through the first dive, which was 480 meters, I think, and found an air bell. And so, you know, Ian was going to go back and do the first solo exploration. He said, well, why are you doing solo exploration? The answer was the visibility wasn't all that great. And the resources that we had there were limited. And so it was like, all right, what's the best way to do this? We had redundancy. We had everybody was carrying large bailout tanks, any one of which could have gotten a person back from the limit of exploration. We were being very conservative on gas. We had oxygen and heliox, stage two sumps, all that kind of stuff. So part of the reason was that doing dual diving on the exploration was going to be safer for a person in bad visibility to sort your own stuff out than it would be to have two. You know, hindsight is 20/20. If I had the whole thing to do over again, I might say, you know what, we really should have used two divers. But we had experiences recently to that expedition where I had almost been killed because a diver who was right behind me in zero vis came and managed to wrap the doggone guideline around both himself and me in zero vis. And it was things like that where we sat there and talked and said, you know, until we get the guideline through, it's going to be safer to be by yourself and make sure you're conservative. And so it was a mental thing where, you know, you knew you were solo caving and so you didn't take risks. You know, you made sure that you weren't going to be anywhere you're going to get caught in your line. We weren't going to go any restrictions. You know, you weren't going to max out on depth or anything like that. And you weren't going to go running off, you know, without a guideline if you ran out of guideline. And, you know, there's legendary stories like George Benjamin in the Bahamas and the Blue Holes, you know, where Rob Palmer reports him saying, well, you know, the one guy stopped at the end of the guideline and the next guy went out 100 meters beyond that so that he had a light so the other guy could see that, you know, and he went another 100 meters. Well, you just don't do that in cave diving and live long. So, you know, we had been reacting to a series of experiences that we had had, and we had talked to British cave divers, and Ian Roland was totally of that same consensus. You know, they work in zero vis all the time over in Britain, so they knew this game. But once you had the guideline installed and you were hauling gear, then it made sense to have people with you because everybody knew where they were going and, you know, you were doing the job. So that was the logic there. And so when Kenny had been waiting at the sump and didn't get, you know, a response from Ian, he felt after some certain number of hours that, okay, you know, a recon isn't going to take that long. And so he came back to Camp 3, woke us all up at like 2 a.m. in the morning. None of us had gotten much sleep because we had just finished a haul run from about the 600 meter level back down. So we were all beat. So there was this heated discussion that went on right then. Kenny wanted to go straight back right then, kit up and go diving and go find Ian. And it was like, okay, you know, one of the first thing you got to realize if you got a rescue situation is you don't do something that's going to harm the rest of the team. And I've been through this now, oh gosh, I don't know, a dozen times. And the answer is you want to put a big filter on your reaction and rationally sit there and calm everybody down and say, all right, what are the factors? You know, what are the things that are going to influence this to where a person lives or dies? And 99% of the time, if you work it out in your head, if a person is thermally stable, or if they have a known air bell somewhere that they could hang out in, the answer is that it's better to let everybody get the sleep that they need, think about what gear you have to get down there, and then do it in a methodical fashion so that when you do get there, you're in a position to actually do something good. And so, you know, this was the case. We took another 5 hours of sleep, and then all of us went down. Kenny kitted up. He went down and found Ian. As it turns out, it wouldn't have made any difference had there been somebody there. You know, he blacked out underwater from what is pretty clearly hypoglycemia. And everybody at the time thought, oh my God, he blacked out from hypoxia. But that's not the case. The black box on that rig clearly showed when we downloaded it a couple of months later, when we got back, it never went below roughly 0.21% oxygen. And so, you know, what would you know, Kenny have done if they had been, you know, a couple hundred meters into that second sump and Ian just suddenly falls over? You know, you could drag him back, but by that time, you know, that he'd gotten back, he would have drowned. So you can play all these Monday morning quarterback games that you want, but the answer was that time was not a factor there. He either was in the air bell sitting on shore saying, you know what, I need a candy bar, or he was gone and nobody was going to make a difference. And you know, that is in fact what we saw on the dive log and on the computer.
Yeah, I'm sure it's absolutely the right decision. I mean, the first premise of the emergency services is never injure or kill a rescuer, and you have to look after yourselves first in all these situations. I mean, the book is brutally honest. It doesn't shy away from the difficult decisions that you had to make, the personality clashes, the hardships, and the perception, even though you wrote a large part of the book yourself, Bill, you know, you haven't shied away from the fact that you are a strong leader, and sometimes it seems like that rubbed people up the wrong way a little bit because it's a long trip. You know, people are tired and getting a bit testy. What's your leadership philosophy in a hostile environment like this?
I have to say, everybody learns. If you're still in this business, you know, you have to learn from mistakes that you've made. In that particular case, you know, we had all worked on it for as much as 10 years. And some of those people, most of them that were on the core team, had been rehearsing for 5 years and some more. Parker and Roland were involved for a full 9 years before they got there. You know, I have a couple of people that I know behind my back refer to me as Captain Safety. Any single person on this team can nuke this expedition. It took years and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to give us the privilege of being here. Don't be the one who nukes the expedition. Okay? So translation, what does that mean? Don't be trying to see if you can set the land speed record between base camp and camp one, or camp one and camp two, so that you can come up and say, I did the camp two run in 8 hours. How about that? You know, or I carried 87 kilograms between camp one and camp two, right? If you try to do something that you feel is going to make you large in the eyes of other people on the expedition, you're in the wrong place. I would much rather have someone who says, you know what, I can only carry 15 kilograms, but I'm going to do it every day, and I'm going to do it safely, and I'm going to get there reliably. That's really what you want. You don't want the person who is speeding and suddenly trips and gets an ACL or breaks their leg, you know, and their, you know, things of thinking, it's very selfish when you get right down to it, because if a person isn't moving in the direction they're supposed to be moving, it doesn't take very long before base camp is aware of that. And suddenly there's a rescue call out. And we had one like this back last year in 2019. And there was a period of 26 hours where an individual had gone AWOL. We didn't know where the hell he was. And within that period of time, we had deployed three teams to go search for them and finally found them. And it turned out that they had simply not bothered to call in on the phone system to let Basecamp know where they were, because they weren't just having a good time. And so, you know, they just kind of gave the middle finger to the people on the expedition who were running it. And if it had been an accident, well, those rescue people would have been there and we would have coordinated through the camps to get there. We have full self-rescue capability on every project that I run. The sked litter is there. The EMT gear is there. Everything that we need to get somebody out if they're injured is there in base camp. I don't depend on mountain rescue or search and rescue or cave rescue to come get us. We have to do that ourselves. If you're in a foreign country, there's no guarantee that anybody in that country has any knowledge of how to even get into that cave you're in. So you better plan to pull yourself out if you mess up.
I just want to finish by touching briefly on the death of Sheck Exley, which came just a short time after Ian's death. And so I hadn't realized that Sheck was really your mentor right from the start, and that he taught you to dive. So Sheck was at Zacaton, cenote in Mexico, diving with Jim Bowden and trying to establish a depth record in that cave, or to try and push himself to new depths. And he died on that dive, and word came back to the expedition via other cavers in the area that Sheck had died. And that must have just seemed an impossible scenario to you, having grown up with the guy who was, you know, as capable as any cave diver ever was. How did that affect you on that expedition, Bill?
it came within days of when we had finally gotten Ian out of the cave and the authorities, you know, took the body and all that. And it actually was Wes Skiles who had gone into town to call in and tell friends in the States what had happened with regards to Ian. And then he gets this shocking news back of what had happened at Zacaton. And what most people probably don't know is that 3 months earlier, we had had a barbecue in Florida as a kind of like the wind up of the final training with the rebreathers before we went to Mexico. And a lot of the frontline cave divers in Florida went to that barbecue. And so everybody was, you know, telling tales. Sheck was there, you know, and other people, and Wes, and we were all going over this. And I remember distinctly talking to Sheck, and it was very, you know, at the time, you know, fraternalistic, you know. And I said, Sheck, they weren't talking about where this site was, by the way. You talk about cavers being secretive. They were not telling anybody that it was Zacaton. Nobody even knew where that was then, except for Bowden. And so, you know, Sheck was sworn to secrecy about where it was. And I said, well, you know, you guys got a project going in the spring. Where are you going? He says, nah, Bill. He says, you know, I can't tell you where I'm going. I told Jim I wouldn't do that. And I says, well, can you tell me what you're thinking about doing? He says, well, I think I'm going to go for a nice round number. And I sat there thinking for a second. I said, 1,000 feet? He goes, yeah, that'd be kind of round. And, you know, that was just the way he was. And, you know, everybody knows that they went down there and rigged double lines and, you know, went down, and only Jim came back. I kind of echoed the thoughts of Mary Ellen Eckhoff at that time, you know, her statement when, you know, she found this out. She had actually gone down the line trying to find him. She went down to 120 meters depth on air trying to find him and came back up. And her words on the slate was, you know, Sheck always comes back, you know, and this time he didn't, because he discovered high pressure nervous syndrome, at least for, you know, for cave divers who are working from the surface. And it was going to happen someday sooner or later, because the previous year, I probably 2-3 times a year, I would have a telephone conversation with Sheck. And the previous summer, he had been to Bushman's Gat over in South Africa. And he had gotten down to, I believe it was 863 feet or something like that. And he was describing it to me. And when he was still probably 100 feet off the deck, you know, 25, 30 meters, could see it with his cave diving lights, he was getting symptoms that were clearly not narcosis. He was seeing multiple copies of images, kind of like fly vision. His left arm was twitching, moving uncontrollably, and he decided, because he could see that sand cone down there, that he was going to make that his target and stop there. When he got there, he had trouble putting his hands on the BC inflator, and it took a lot longer than he wanted it to take, but it finally went. And at that point, I think he dropped his reel, locked it off, and then just, you know, slid up the line until he got to his first decompression saw. And when he told that to me, I was shaking, sitting there on the floor holding the phone to my head, going, damn, why don't you get in touch with the Duke Hyperbaric Medicine Center and go simulate this dive from now on if you're ever going to go any deeper anywhere? And that discussion, you know, I guess just was dismissed at the time because he figured, well, I've been to 863, another 100 feet isn't going to make a difference. And so off they went to Zacatone. We had offered to give them rebreathers, you know, if they wanted to try it again the next year. And the problem that they're playing, and you know, and it wasn't until 2002 when I was invited to go to Zacatone to build a LIDAR model of the surface part of the caves. This was while we were thinking about trying to get funding to build something like DepthX that later went back and autonomously mapped Zacatone all the way down to 335 meters. But Jim Bowden came along on that trip, and they had a shot line rigged into a smaller hypogene cave on the property called La Pilita, and it was known to be at least 105 meters deep. Nobody really knew how big it was because you couldn't see. The visibility wasn't that good. But Bowden, to his credit, knew that people were out working hard all day, and so he would always have a set of tanks charged and sitting on the edge of that cenote. And we'd come back at night, you know, and I'd put on the set of double hundreds, and I'd go, and I swam around the surface and looked at it, you know, enjoyed the warm water, and went back and had dinner. The very next night, I came back, picked up that set of charged tanks. I dropped in. I went down to about 25, 30 meters depth, and I swam all the way around the rim of the cenote wall. And then I came back for dinner. But I noticed as I was going around that there was this vertical line going all the way down. And I asked Jim about it. He says, oh, yeah, I just put that in. It's a shot line. You know, it goes to the bottom. The next day, I came around, swam around the edge. I got to that shot line. And I just punched my BC and I skydived down to 65 meters on air. And I said, okay, that's enough of that. I went back to the surface. And the next day we get back there, I put the tanks on, I go around, I start sliding down that run, and I'm down to 75 meters. I'm going, stop. What the hell are you doing? And I went back up that line, decompressed, and I went over to Bowden and I said, I think I understand what was going on here. I said, you really got into this idea of falling down that rope and seeing just how far you can get in the shortest possible time. Those guys were dropping more than 45 meters a minute when they were headed for 300 meters depth. And I think in retrospect, had they switched to rebreathers, had they cut their time of descent, or not cut their time, but extended their time of descent, you know, dropped it down to maybe 20 meters a minute or something like that, or even 15 meters a minute, using the rebreathers, paying the penalty on the far end of the decompression, I think both of those guys would still be here.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And a much better way to do that sort of diving, obviously, in retrospect, but they were very much limited by the gas they could carry, I guess.
And the knowledge of the time. Nobody knew that that was going to happen, except for Sheck. You know, he'd experienced it over in Bushmangot the previous year, you know, so... To me, had they gone and simulated that in a chamber, you know, this is getting back to the idea of risk. If you can simulate, do it before you go trying this, you know, for real. Because once you go below 200 meters in any kind of diving from the surface, you're rolling the roulette wheel as to whether, you know, you're going to come back well or damaged or dead. It's just the facts. Humans weren't intended to drop like rockets, you know, to 400 meters depth, go diving for a while, and then rocket back to the surface. The physiology isn't cut out to do that. So, yeah, rehearse, rehearse, rehearse.
Good advice for any young man, Bill. Look, you've been very generous with your time, Bill. We haven't even touched on the other
amazing half of your life, which is your interest in space and the work you're doing with NASA to try and develop autonomous robots and so forth for exploration. But we'll have to leave it there. So, Bill, thank you so much for joining me. You are truly one of the legends of our discipline, and it's been a great honor to chat with you.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time.
That's it for this episode of Real Risk. If you're a risk taker or know someone who'd be good for the show, please send me an email on admin@speleopix.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Subscribe, give me a rating, but most importantly, join me for the next one. We'll see you again on Real Risk.